Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and every so often I like to get back in front of the microphone. My role is a different one on the network right now, but when a book crosses my desk that I think is particularly interesting and noteworthy, I read it and I try to talk to the author. In this case, I'm very pleased to say we have Gary Kulik on the show, and we'll be talking about his wonderful and very thought-provoking book, War Stories, False Atrocity Tales, Swift Boaters, and Winter Soldiers, What Really Happened in Vietnam. As I said, when I first saw this book, I thought, well, this is an interesting topic. So I ordered it from the publisher and I read it, and it was more than interesting. Actually, it's one of the best books I've ever read on Vietnam. It's not actually on the war itself so much, although the final chapters do analyze a particular incident. It's really about the way in which, as Gary says, the war has been framed. And we'll get into that discussion later. Gary has a lot to say about it, but you'll see that there's a lot of maybe myth-busting is too strong. Well, maybe myth-busting isn't too strong. There are a lot of things that Gary points out in the book that we believe about Vietnam, which just simply aren't true. And he has some interesting hypotheses, I think proven, really statements about why it is the case that we still misunderstand the war in the way that we misunderstand it. So, Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm now retired. I worked for 15 years at the Smithsonian Institution and for another 10 years as a senior manager at Winterthur, a museum garden and library outside of Delaware. I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts, graduated from St. Michael's College in Vermont, just came back from my 50th anniversary, and spent a year as a VISTA volunteer, found that I was not a very good community organizer, and decided to go to graduate school in American Studies, and I was a first-year student at Brown University when I received my draft notice. And the critical part of that was that I had applied to my draft board, which was in Springfield, as a conscientious objector, willing to serve in the military. There were two categories at that time, and my choice was to accept the reality that I would serve for 2 years as a medic. So that's, and I did. I did do my 2 years, 10 months of that time in Vietnam as a medic, and later as a clerk. And I can provide a little more detail about that. Mm-hmm. I went back to graduate school. I got my doctorate in American Studies at Brown, as I said, and worked for a time in a small museum in Rhode Island, and then received an appointment at the Smithsonian. We could get into this a little bit further, but I think I went out of my way to put Vietnam behind me mm-hmm. for years and years. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I found that I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, that gets us right into my next question, and that is, if that's okay, sorry to interrupt,
absolutely.
But why did you write War Stories?
Well, the beginning of the book has a very simple history. In the last years of my job at Winterthur, I was increasingly unhappy. I was not pleased with the direction in which the institution was going, and ultimately I decided I couldn't support it and resigned. But while I was still working, my wife said to me, you need a project. So the project became a study of Vietnam War memoir. I've been collecting memoir for quite some time, and I have an extensive personal library. And so I wanted to begin not with infantry, but with the nurses. I'd been in the same field in Vietnam. My wife had a background in medical history. And all this began with a very close reading of a book by Linda Van Devanter called Home Before Morning, about an acclaimed book, sold many, many copies. She was widely seen as, as the single most important writer about the nursing experience in Vietnam. And her story was a reprise of the World War I stories of innocence lost and betrayed. But she added a third, innocence lost and betrayed, healed by therapy. So the book took off, and what I increasingly found is that it was a pastiche of completely unreliable anecdote, medical procedures that made no sense, viewing of American soldiers badly mutilated by the North that, again, made no sense based on my experience, where they were lying outside of the morgue, exposed to the flies and vermin of Vietnam. That simply wouldn't have happened. So that became a spur to a second edge, and that in many ways is the moral center of my book. This moral balancing act that I attempted between the exposure of false atrocity stories I knew to be wildly exaggerated and very likely false, while at the same time recognizing that we committed some egregious war crimes in Vietnam. The false atrocity tales were, to my knowledge, a novelty. No one else was writing about these things. And at a certain point, I think I began writing with an edge and an anger that wasn't simply that the stories were told, it was that they were widely believed by credulous journalists in prestigious newspapers and magazines, the New Yorker, the New York Times. So that was the spur, and all of this begins to come together in 2004. John Kerry is running, and the Swift voters emerge. So I spent a substantial amount of time researching the issues that the Swift voters raised, and in the end, I felt very good about writing a book that would make both liberals and conservatives uncomfortable.
I think you've done that.
Thank you.
I really do think you've done that. We'll come back to all these things. Let's go back to the memoir literature just for a second.
Sure.
I had not read Van Devanter's book, but another book that you talk about at some length, in War Stories, which I imagine a lot of the listeners to this podcast have read, is Michael Hare's Dispatches, which I remember, actually, just to tell a personal anecdote, when I was, for some reason, I was sick in high school. I think I had strep or something, and I told my mom to get me a book about Vietnam, and she brought me Dispatches. This would have been about 78, and I couldn't make heads or tails of the book. I read about six pages of it, and I was like, I don't get it. What? Mm-hmm. But I do remember the fanfare around the book and the blurbs on the book and the fact that it's now taught in classes, and it's taught as nonfiction in classes. And so you have some good things to say about this, things that were really eye-opening to me as somebody that kind of came to admire the book, thinking that it was sort of nonfiction. But go ahead, if you could talk a little bit about Hare's Dispatches, that we'd appreciate that.
Well, it's a very deceptive book. It took him several years to write. It's not Dispatches from the War. He came back and mulled over this for quite some time. I consider it a book that dramatically blurs fact and fiction. He made up composite characters. He didn't always tell people, didn't tell his readers that he was doing that. Only the French got it right. They yeah. published it as fiction, and so it's a mordant, cynical book. The one thing that leaps out, of course, is that Hur had a great ear, And so he picked up on this, the unique language of Vietnam. So anybody who was there recognizes that her skill in doing that. But again, the blur fiction was disturbing to me, and obviously is a motif that runs through my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I mean, you mentioned the hair cynicism, because he describes the war as sort of a disaster, but the GIs right. in it as being, and this is oddly incongruous given the fact that he thinks the war is a disaster, but the GIs in it are always very eager to help him do everything.
Yeah.
They love him.
Yeah.
I'm like, well,
I think this, yeah, this was, who wouldn't want to be noticed by a journalist?
Yeah.
Sure. That's definitely going to happen.
And you do point out another thing about the book, is that there are lots of points in it that, and I suppose that for somebody with a better, as you put it, a literary ear or a literary sensibility than mine, this is clever and interesting, but some of the book doesn't make any sense at all. Like, for
that's
example,
right.
you mentioned this expression he uses, war on a Cracker Jack box.
Exactly.
What does that mean exactly? I don't think anybody knows what that means.
I think several readings of this passage never yield a clear meaning. He's got another passage where he basically asks how many, at what point does running in front of a machine gun become an act of cowardice? Well, this is bizarre. I think soldiers and Marines understood that there were men who took needless risks,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't cowardice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's this combination of a kind of postmodern cleverness, this distancing from the actual experience, the blurring of truth and fiction, the creation of composite characters. I found it necessary to write about it with a certain edge and a deep skepticism.
Yeah, because I mean, if you read the reviews, which I did go back and read some of the reviews, because computers are great that way, you can go back and read original reviews.
Right.
Some of the things that were said about the book are positively embarrassing today. In the sense of just being so over the top in terms of praise.
Well, that awful quote from John Le Carré, the best book I've ever read about men in war.
So maybe we could talk a little bit about that. I don't believe there is an insane Vietnam vet in Dispatches. There are some people that don't act quite normal, I guess I'd put it that way, but can you trace for us at all the history of the notion of the damaged Vietnam vet? When does it appear, and does it appear in the memoir literature first, or is it in film, or where does it come from?
I think that I locate it in what was first referred to as Vietnam syndrome and later morphed into PTSD. It's very much the work of a group of activist anti-war psychiatrists, Robert J. Lifton,
yes,
most prominent among them. And you'll note in the book that the earliest statements that Lifton made in public, and this is well before the book he wrote, which came out of therapy sessions with veterans, all of whom were members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So he's interviewing a small subset, a tiny subset of Vietnam veterans. But even before he does that, he's talking before Congress, and I don't have the quotes in front of me, but he's deeply worried that something terrible has happened to the souls of veterans, and that we will soon see this acted out in the streets of America. And then, of course, we get Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And
Travis Bickle. Travis Bickle.
A host of other film. And this trope continues to structure the way in which young journalists present war, that war is somehow soul-destroying by its very nature, that everybody who goes to war is damaged in some sense, and that among evidence of this damage is also murderous activity, suicidal activity. And that trope gets fastened on very, very soon. And as someone who follows how people are now writing about our current veterans, that trope has persisted and remains the dominant way we think about veterans. Something happened to them, and we need to be wary. We need to pity them. We need to find ways to support them. Increasingly now, from the veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, that wasn't the case when Lifton was presenting an image of this very dangerous, asocial Vietnam vet whose soul had been effectively destroyed by going to war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, this was linked to an utterly false notion. It was something truly, truly awful about the war in Vietnam, different from previous wars, that somehow more damaging. And yet an instant of reflection should have realized, people should have realized that casualty rates in World War II were dramatically, dramatically high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually, Lifton is an interesting character, and after reading your book, I went back and read some of the things, again, computers are wonderful this way, read some of the things that Lifton had written in the New York Times and other places like this, and about the notion of the atrocity-producing situation.
Yeah.
Sorry to laugh, but...
And that, you know, Jane Fonda would repeat that later on. Situations produce atrocities.
Yeah, not people. Yes, and so then it comes down. I mean, then and this shifts moral authority for the war, whether it was a disaster or not, away from the people that actually committed the atrocities, if they committed them, to some other nebulous system, right?
Yes. No. In fact, the whole premise of the Winter Soldier investigation, which was very few people even heard about it until John Kerry ran for president, and he had a cameo appearance in the film, and all of a sudden that film gets much wider release. And the premise was that individuals aren't to be held accountable, and it was a premise that made the investigation much less effective. People weren't willing to name names, to give dates.
Mm-hmm.
The focus was entirely on the guilt of the Army as a whole, the American people as well, but not on individuals.
Yeah, that does seem to be exactly right. So, I mean, again, I think we need to get this out on the table. I think studies have been done now of Vietnam veterans and how they fared in life, and they fared pretty well. I have an example of one. And I understand that anecdote, the plural of anecdote is not data, but my uncle came back, served for a while, retired as a colonel, and then became a very successful insurance salesman.
I don't doubt it. Yeah.
An avid skier.
This is true for many draftees as well. I think that, again, we've got this, over time, a number of restudies of the initial studies of PTSD, which came out in the mid to late 80s, began by suggesting that almost half of us would suffer from PTSD in our lifetime. And those studies have been repeated now on two different occasions, and the numbers have been dramatically, dramatically lowered. And a very prominent a psychiatrist who teaches at Harvard named Richard McNally, wrote a book called mm-hmm. Trauma, which is very important to my analysis. This was simply a letter he wrote. No one's going to see this. A letter, a footnote into the AMA's journal saying, yeah, if in fact we're talking about day-to-day dysfunction, the numbers are now down in the single digits for Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And as you indicated, there's lots of us have moved on. That I think, given the trope that now afflicts all veterans, I sometimes think the best answer is that in the vast majority of instances, war neither builds character nor destroys it. What war does is reveal it.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about a related issue. Part of the evidence that is given for the fact that Vietnam somehow damaged soldiers is that, and let me put it in the starkest possible terms, that the rate at which GIs committed atrocities was higher in Vietnam than in other wars. And I'm not talking about the kinds of atrocities which one might include, for example, in, what was his name? Nick Turton, is that his
Turst.
Name? Yeah, Turst, yeah, name. Yeah. He includes bombing campaigns as atrocities, but let's exclude those for a second. Let's talk about My Lai-type atrocities, that is where soldiers actually shoot people, that there was somewhat higher in Vietnam. You talk a little bit about this. What is your opinion on that?
Well, there's no way to know that. Mm-hmm. There's no empirical evidence that would allow anyone to say with authority that the incidence of war crimes was on the American side was greater in Vietnam than in any previous war. I just don't know how you would quantify that. One of the things two things I want to say about that. I co-authored a piece with a Berkeley scholar of Vietnamese history named Peter Zinnemann, a long piece, 40-some pages, in a journal called Cross Currents, East Asian History and Culture Journal. And those 40 pages were devoted to attacking Mr. Church. And I'm proud to have co-authored that. I'm proud to have revealed him to be an incredibly sloppy, tendentious scholar. And I've forgotten the second thing I wanted to say about that.
Well, we can say about Terce's book, which is called, I'm sorry, I'm blanked on it too. Kill Anything That Moves, is that right?
Kill Anything That Moves.
Yes, Kill Anything That Moves got a huge amount of press and almost all of it favorable.
A lot of it was favorable, and it's been translated into Vietnamese with the, there's one paragraph in the English version, which lists known or suspected atrocities by the North or by the Viet Cong. And when it was translated in Vietnam, that paragraph was deleted.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no evidence that Terce ever protested that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But again, the thesis of this book is, again, a sort of Lifton's thesis of the atrocity-producing situation, and that is the way in which the United States prosecuted the war in Vietnam was such that it put GIs in situations where they were more or less compelled to commit atrocities very often. Let's just put it that way. I don't know how you quantify that, but that's the thesis of the book, and it's a long book. Where does he get the – I mean, you say that there's no evidence of this, but just to play devil's advocate for a second, what does he talk about then?
Well, and we know the most egregious atrocities. Certainly, My Lai was there. More recently, two journalists from the Toledo Blade revealed a long-running series of war crimes committed by a recon unit called Tiger Force.
Mm-hmm.
The Tiger Force book was persuasive to me. We also know that there is a list of war crimes that is suspected and some real that is now in the archives at the University of Michigan. So he made some use of that. He also made use of a series of sources, some of which are reliable, some of which are notoriously unreliable. I talk about extensively a Marine veteran named Scott Camille. Buried in Tirsa's footnotes is a piece that takes at face value Camille's stories, which I went to great length to cast doubt on, even interviewing men who served with him. He's just not a reliable analyst of American war crime. So there's no question that we committed war crimes. So Tirsa has that right.
Mm-hmm.
There's also no question that we attempted to fight a war of insurgency with extraordinary firepower. And inevitably, that produced far more civilian death than it should have. We were fighting a war of insurgency as if it were World War II. Widely known by people who served that rather than employ traditional infantry tactics faced with a sniper, fire and maneuver, it was much, much easier to call in artillery or gunships. So we did.
Mm-hmm.
We did. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, Tirsa has a piece of the story right. And that's a powerful part of the story, but the overall story, I think, he gets egregiously wrong. And the other piece, I've just now remembered this, as we know, as we get deeper into World War II, for example, and I'm thinking now of Rick Atkinson's
mm-hmm.
trilogy he did on the war in Europe. And we're getting evidence in North Africa of soldiers shooting Berber tribesmen for sport. We know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the French colonial troops raped their way up the Italian peninsula, and they were under our command. We look the other way. So we're beginning to move away from that Greatest Generation mythos and taking a harder look at what happened in Europe and the Pacific. It shouldn't be surprising that in moments of stress, men can lose their moral bearing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I can say that as somebody that studied the My Lai massacre extensively, there have been a number of documentaries about it where they've gone back and they've interviewed people who were there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We know they were there. And they make claims which are absolutely impossible. And I know this for a fact because I've read this sort of eyewitness testimony that was taken at the time, like we cut people's heads off and we cut their tongues off and we danced around with their severed limbs and, we burnt them to death and this other sort of stuff, which definitely didn't happen. There's no question it didn't happen. But the interviewers never questioned it at all.
That's right.
And I just found it kind of rather shocking. And there's one bit of testimony that I remember particularly from a recent, I think it was a Frontline documentary that was made several years ago. They talked to a fellow who did seem disturbed, and he described decapitating and cutting the tongues out of the mouths of Vietnamese civilians and things. This stuff did not happen. There's no question it didn't happen. But there was no effort to question. It was as if what he had to say was sort of beyond questioning.
Yes. No, I think now of the Wallace Terry book, Bloods. There are five stories, five veterans interviewed for that book that make outrageous claims, very similar to the ones that you've seen. And once again, reviewers were credulous in accepting these claims. Without thinking that, wait a minute, how can I, can we get some evidence for this? For years and years, and it may still be true, that veterans would come back and say, I was up in a helicopter, we threw Viet Cong, while we're trying to interrogate them. And I think I put an end, I hope I put an end to those stories. I'm mentioning first that none of these stories have ever been corroborated. And at a minimum, you would think journalistic ethics would require you to do that. And the reality, of course, is for anyone who's ever flown in a helicopter, you can barely hear the person sitting next to you because of the noise of the rotor overhead. The Army helicopters flew with both doors open. This is the idea that this is a place for an interrogation is utter nonsense. But that story will probably linger longer than my efforts to refute it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, doubtless. So I want to go on past that story to another story, which you deal with, and that is spitting. But before that, I want you to talk a little bit about the Winter Soldiers investigation and its history and the way it has been, I guess, accepted by, I want to call it popular mythology.
Well, I think the investigation itself was partially funded by Jane Fonda, and it took place in Detroit, 1971, and it received almost no publicity at the time. People would later claim that obviously the networks were never going to air shows like this, but when we're talking about hideous scenes of sexual torture, that's probably a more powerful reason why Winter Soldier wasn't aired. It became a film as well.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara Koppel, well-known documentarian, and others did the film. The film dies. We don't hear anything about it until 2004. And Carey makes a brief cameo appearance. The Swift Boaters seize on this, and the film becomes very prominent once again.
Well, it's on Netflix. It is literally on Netflix. Yes,
is that right? Yes, it was
on Netflix. I watched it.
Well, it also in the a company, another company brought the film out of mothballs and began showing it around the country in the fall of 2004, mostly in places that were likely to be liberal, Princeton, Minneapolis, I forget where else. So I wanted to read the reviews, many of them coming out in alternative papers, one egregiously awful review in the Washington Post by a film critic who still writes for the Post. And so you had this extraordinary moment where Swift Boaters were saying, all these guys are frauds, none of this happened. And left liberal reviewers are talking about it as the unvarnished truth, despite a generation of work suggesting that all documentaries are often blur the line between film and fiction, fact and fiction. So both of these positions can't be right. And in fact, they were both wrong. I think I simply wrote that, you know, this is, we need to look at this without this ridiculous Manichaean dichotomy, truth or false, and falsehood. You know, what I discovered should have been available to others. The Army took every single one of these allegations with great seriousness and interviewed. They went and interviewed, and I believe the Navy did the same thing for the Marines who were testifying. And I don't have the number right in front of me. I read about it in the book, but a considerable number of these men just backed away. Now, they may have been intimidated. I wouldn't rule that out. But the wild, many of the wild assertions and the wildest assertions, some of them you have mentioned, came in the first morning of that testimony with 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, and that was Scott Camille and another fabulous named Joe Bangert, seemed to be competing. This was a comment made to me years later by a psychiatrist who was also on that panel. Seem to be competing with each other to tell the most gruesome, sexually tinged atrocity mm-hmm. stories. And as I said earlier, I paid close attention to Mr. Camille and interviewed people who served with him, and I find him completely unreliable.
So let me, while we're talking about the Swift Boat veterans, here's the part that probably would make conservatives, or at least opponents of John Kerry, a little bit uncomfortable. You don't like a lot of what the Swift Boat veterans have to say about John Kerry's record.
Well, I think not only that, I think I demonstrated that some of it can't possibly be true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you had this egregious incident where Kerry is awarded a Bronze Star for valor, which is not an especially high award for valor. On a mission in which one of his fellow Swift Boat commanders comes on a major television show in the middle of the election and says no one was fired. He couldn't have been, you know, it was, you can't have an act of valor if no one is firing at you. There was no action that day. It's a guy named Thurlow, and it turns out that Thurlow was himself awarded a Bronze Star for valor. And the citation clearly indicates they were under fire. Yeah. So this is how many incidents like this do you need before it didn't take me long to agree with John McCain, who immediately came to Kerry's defense, uh-huh. thinking that the attacks on his service, on his medals, was dishonest and dishonest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's an interesting perspective. I mean, I don't know if the Swift Boaters got the upper hand in that. I think maybe in the American mind they might have, but I remember thinking myself that people with those, it just didn't make sense.
Well, you could, I think they were decisive in the election. I think what has happened now, and I think I use this term, I'm not going to be able to quote myself, but if you look up Swift Boating on Wikipedia, I believe there's a quote from me saying that this has become a synonym for, and I'm not getting the quote exactly right, but a synonym for dishonest attack.
Oh, good. Well, that's
Swift Boating has come down to us.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, metaphor for this.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So then let's go on from John Kerry's record in the Swift Boaters to another tale that you hear a lot about Vietnam, yeah. in addition to people being thrown out of helicopters and this kind of thing. And that is veterans returning often to San Francisco and being spat upon.
Right.
Seems like
right.
San Francisco
right.
is where it happens. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think I spent some time analyzing the stories. There's a book, and I'm blanking on the title now. Once prominent Chicago Trib journalist. I'll find it in a minute here. But anyway, he's still writing. And he collected a vast number of these stories. I read the piece he did in the Chicago Tribune, and I closely read the book. And what you quickly find is that these are formulaic stories, and the principal formula involves a solitary female spitter, usually a hippie, approaching a soldier or marine in an airport, San Francisco, L.A., Seattle. that soldier. And the soldier's reaction typically is not anger or not any desire to retaliate again in the majority of instances, but just, you know, how could this happen? The journalist I'm thinking of, his last name is Green. And so these are formulaic stories that single out a hippie female as the protagonist. They surface only years later. There are some, it's a very small number of contemporaneous I Was Spit Upon stories. So these are years after the fact they begin to surface. And as I read the Green stories, if you tell me something that I know is improbable, then I'm probably not going to believe your story. And there are just too many improbables in these stories. But the largest issue for me was there's nobody who says, I wasn't spit upon, but my buddy was. I saw it happen. There's no corroboration. When I returned from Vietnam, I came through Seattle, Tacoma. I was surrounded by other veterans. You know, this was a factory process. We're on our way home. So the idea of a solitary veteran walking through a cavernous airport on his own and spit upon by a female hippie just struck me as given everything I knew, given the length of time it took to begin telling these stories, suggested to me that this was a metaphor for how a lot of veterans felt, how they felt they were being received by their fellow citizens. So this kind of whether it's a false memory or just the story I need to tell. And of course, the fundamental reality here is that we don't get these stories in proliferation until the Rambo movie. And Rambo has a rant toward the end of that first Rambo movie, where he talks about being spit upon.
Mm-hmm.
And I the movie had a tremendous impact on transferring the notion that many of our fellow citizens thought we were dupes or criminals, or we could have tell a story where. I was talking about my conscientious objector status, and somebody said, in effect, that there were easier ways to beat the draft than that. And of course, there were. I knew that was the point of, but that kind of disrespect, which lots of veterans felt. I mean, no one, when I came home, no one wanted to hear about whatever good we were doing. No one wanted to hear stories of heroism, certainly. No one wanted to hear any stories.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the spitting becomes this way of expressing how the country greeted us. But I think in the vast majority, and I'm not saying you can't prove a negative, somewhere somebody spit upon a soldier, a Marine. But the proliferation of these stories simply struck me as wrong.
You conclude the book with a bit of a departure. You investigate an atrocity story. And I think that's told right. I'm trying to remember this, Terry Whitmore, is that right?
Terry Whitmore.
Yes, Terry Whitmore plays a principal role in this, and it occurs in Quang Tri province. Is that right?
That's right, October 1967. And unlike many other false atrocity stories, Whitmore identifies the company, identifies the date, the time, roughly the time. So
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Whitmore and how he came to tell the story, and then it's sort of unraveling.
Sure. Whitmore is a deserter. He is ends up in a hospital in Japan. He'd been wounded, I believe, at Cantina, while serving Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 1st Marines. And he gets a Japanese girlfriend. The girlfriend is on the left, and she helps him desert. So he ends up going through Moscow. He ends up living. He would live his life mostly in Sweden. Mark Lane, who wrote a notoriously bad book called Conversations with Americans, runs into him in Stockholm and gets him to tell the story. Whitmore would later produce a book. Simon & Schuster, I believe, was the publisher. And it would be reprinted some years later by the University of Mississippi Press to positive blurbs. The story that there's sufficient discrepancy between the oral interview in Mark Lane and then Whitmore's own book to bring some skepticism to this, but didn't seem to dissuade people who wanted to republish it or people who thought it was reliable. I thought the story made no sense. 300 people killed. It was on. You know, we're talking about a company of Marines committing an atrocity on the scale of the Mean Line. So I want to get to the bottom of it. And getting to the bottom of it required some patience, some emailing of Bravo Company. 1-1 had a website. So I'm on the website asking these questions, rousing suspicion. Ultimately, I get the name of a company commander and a lance corporal who were court-martialed. And then I'm able to call up Washington and get a copy of what's known as the Article 39 investigation. Hundreds of pages of testimony. These hundreds of pages of testimony, because they're referring to the same incident as Whitmore, are the conclusive refutation of Whitmore's claims, period. There's nothing like this happens. The Marines recognize that one young lance corporal took a woman out from her hot bunker, really, and shot her in the back. Likely in front of her children. The killing of a prisoner is murder and has been in the American military since the middle of the 19th century. And they never found the body. So he was charged with attempted murder instead. And those last two chapters of the book are both the refutation of Whitmore's grand, grotesque story and an explication of to the best of my ability, of what happened that morning in Quangtree.
Mm-hmm. And what did Whitmore say had happened, and why did he say it?
Well, why did he say it is only he would know, and he died fairly young. I mean, he reconciled with his family. He was able to come back to the United States under Carter's amnesty. But the suspicion here is you've got a deserter justifying his actions. He actually makes a final appearance in the anti-war film Sir No Sir, and he's basically saying the government. So the government forced him into this situation. He didn't in this final. He comes across looking very unhealthy. And I assume he would die a few months or years after that film. He has no longer anything to say about this massacre that he participated in. But it's clear that the blame goes all to the government. So it seems to me here's a young man trying to defend himself. Mark Lane wants atrocity stories, finds them in Sweden. And the temptation to tell these false stories as self-justification is, I'm assuming, would be great. And I wanted to comment on this because I'm often asked, why would people lie? And it turns out there's an incredible piece of journalism in the current New Yorker by a woman named Rachel Avivi. The title of the piece is Remembering the Murder You Didn't Commit. And it's this complicated explication of a series of false confessions that led people to serve time unjustified. And it turns out that DNA evidence is now exonerated close to 100 people in the last few years, all of whom confessed. If there's a particularly awful murder, sexually tinged murder in a big city, the police fully understand they're going to get phone calls from people who simply want to be the center of attention for a time. They're going to get false confessions. That's part of the reason they don't reveal all the details. So it's a much more common phenomenon than you would think. And I think about this as again, there were a small number of people on the far left who wanted Mark Lane, most notoriously, wanted these stories. And Winter Soldier investigation was designed to bring these stories to the fore. So again, these are people now in the headlights, and if they're slightest bit unhinged, slightest bit guilty, you can quickly see where the exaggerations come from.
So, is there any hope that the framing of the war that took place in its closing years and continued in the 1970s, and I guess continues to this day if we look at the reception of Nick Turtz's book. Is there any hope that will change and we'll come to see Vietnam as what it was?
In a new light.
There is
hope, but I have to begin by saying that the debate on the war among American historians of the United States, is locked in place. It's the same debate as the debate on the war itself. So all of the positions of the anti-war movement, that, for example, to offer just one, that Ho Chi Minh and his minions were really nationalist and communist secondarily, have been codified into what's known as the Orthodox School of American historians writing about Vietnam. The opposition comes from people like Mark Moyer and Sorley, and they're basically arguing we could have won. So here is the 60s all over again. This debate has not advanced. Now, what's hopeful to me is that there's a new generation, a younger generation of scholars who have two great advantages. They were too young to be caught up in the emotion of the war. But their principal advantage is that they read Vietnamese. And so we're getting a series of books coming out from these younger scholars, Peter Zinnemann among them, my co-author of that piece, Attacking Terse, but Pierre Asselin, Ed Miller, Ian Hong Nguyen, and the list could go on. That people with access to Vietnamese officials, with the ability to get access to some records, it's going to be the Vietnamese are not going to reveal what's in their archives. But we're now getting a much more complicated view of the North, and it's a long time in coming. So that's my hope, that that we begin to see the war from the Vietnamese side in a far more sophisticated way than we have. Having said that, let me be clear about my moral position. I believe that the United States had every right and every duty to support the South Vietnamese. But we did it all wrong. And we had no business taking over the war, sending ground troops into Vietnam. Having said that, I still think there's room to... My hope is that these younger scholars who read Vietnamese will help to reframe what the war was about, rather than going back to the highly emotional aversion that now plays out in scholarship. The anti-war movement was right on all its points versus, well, we really could have won the war.
Actually, I lurk on a Vietnam War listserv where these things are talked about all the time.
and yes, what is the listserv?
I can't remember the name of it right now. I just can't remember the name of it. It's run from the University of Buffalo. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't remember the name of it. I really don't. I know it's one of the Buffalo listservs, one of the ones that's run.
Oh, okay. That's the listserv that I'm on as well, VVAR.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. And I lurk there. I don't ever say anything, but I know that I know that the Vietnam War is being refought there practically every day. So that's very interesting.
It's an interesting site, and if there are veterans listening, I'd encourage them.
Oh yeah, no, it is. It's terribly interesting. I don't feel like I have the standing to say anything because you there are people there who really know what they're talking about because they were there.
Right.
And that's
right.
The part that I find absolutely fascinating. I'd also like to put a plug in for, I believe it's Texas Tech has a huge archive of interviews with veterans. And I've listened to many of them, and it's an absolutely fantastic resource.
Yeah, no, I've been to Texas Tech twice. I've spoken at their conferences. I've done research there. What they've done is
remarkable. It is, and they really deserve credit for sort of saving the legacy of the war and all this material and data and these other things. That they have a kind of virtual archive which is accessible to everyone.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable resource, and I hope whoever.
I completely agree.
Whoever does the funding for these things, give those people more money, please.
Well, they would appreciate that.
Yeah,
I'll make sure they know that.
They're doing absolutely fantastic work. And I know that when I was doing the first research on the book that I'm writing now, I listened to thousands of hours of those interviews. And they're just wonderfully conducted by really dedicated people that know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And they let the veterans speak, which is really great, I think. So that's a plug for them. And I want to give one more plug for your book, and I want to do it in an odd way. I want to make sure that people read it and not think that it's a really partisan book, because it's not. And so I'm just a series of statements. So you're not saying that, for example, there weren't any atrocities in Vietnam. You're saying there were.
Yes, of course.
Yes, of course. And you're not saying there's no such thing as PTSD, because there is, right?
No, there is. That's
right,
correct.
Right. And you're not saying that everything that was said at the Winter Soldier's investigation is bullshit, because some of it wasn't.
That's correct.
Right, yeah, exactly. And that much of what you can find in the memoir literature is completely valid.
valid in terms of that person's
experience. Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, sure. I just think it's important for people to know that the book is not exactly it's definitely not a polemic for or against the war or for or against the anti-war movement or for or against the people that fought there. It's a kind of assessment of the way in which it has been framed and the way in which people who both were in the anti-war movement and who went and who weren't and were just engaged citizens have elected to talk about it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
And that was what was really eye-opening to me. I didn't realize that Travis Bickle had that kind of lineage. Going back to Taxi Driver. So it was very eye-opening for me.
We're still dealing with that.
Yeah, I understand.
You read what's coming out of Iraq these days.
Yes. It's funny because also to say something about Netflix for just a moment, they for some reason they're releasing Army war films that were made. They're films about soldiers coming home after World War II. And one of them, I don't remember the name of it. I wish I did. But one of them is about soldiers who came back from World War II, basically with psychological injuries. Mm-hmm. And, sure. You know, they begin with statistics that basically says 20% of the people we deal with have severe psychological problems. 20%. This is World War. This is the World War II.
That was contemporary.
They made this film, and they show them treating these films. And actually, the treatments are kind of funny because they're a little bit Freudian and they're kind of crazy. And but the point is that obviously the Department of the Army or the Army at the Pentagon at that time was very concerned with this. I mean, mm-hmm. this film was suppressed, by the way. It was not released to the public, right? Because they didn't want to say that 20% of these casualties were what essentially they would have called at the time shell shock, or I think they called it battle fatigue. Is that right?
Battle fatigue was the term.
Yeah.
And the percentage of men who suffered from battle fatigue, particularly we know a reasonable amount about this, and I write some about it in the European theater, was very high.
Yeah.
There's the late writer Paul Fussell.
In his book Wartime.
His book Wartime.
Yeah.
Out of his experience, basically said, look, you serve for the length of time that I did, and he was a platoon leader in a company that was in substantial combat. One of three things is going to happen. You're going to die. You're going to be wounded. Hopefully, it's the million-dollar wound that sends you home, or you're going to break.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not going to be able to take it anymore.
Well, I have to say, seeing this on Netflix, I'm amazed that the Army released it even to this day, but it was suppressed originally after they made it. They made a bunch of films about reintegration, basically, because they had millions of people to deal with. And, you know, they wanted to get the word out about that all these GIs coming home, and here's what they faced, and this is what it's going to be like, and we're going to retrain them. And most of them were very upbeat. And this one is certainly upbeat, too, I have to say. But it does open with a statistic that says something like 20% of the casualties that they deal with at Walter Reed or wherever it was are essentially psychological trauma. And they show these guys, and you can tell that some of them are not, you know, I mean, they definitely have some sort of neurological damage. But the Army took it very seriously, you know. I mean, they knew.
And I think they, you know, they were certainly the Army Medical Department was very serious about this. And you know, the context for this is the casualty rates in the European.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, the 4th Infantry Division. Division I served with in Vietnam suffered 252% casualties over 10 months.
Right.
So that means they were, and that's the division as a whole. So that includes support troops and frontline troops. So the casualty rate of maneuver battalions, the infantry, most likely was far higher.
Mm-hmm.
So you're replacing infantry companies every 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So with that kind of carnage, people will break.
Yeah, sure. They will. That's right. They will, and they always have. I think anybody that's read about the Civil War in any previous knows that this is a horrendous thing. And, you know, I guess I don't want to say that there wasn't anything terribly unusual about Vietnam. I don't know. I'm not really an expert. But it seems to me that the experience of Korean War veterans, World War I, but World War II, it was, you know, there's something about this experience that is damaging, and we should acknowledge that. You know, whether it's damaging in the sort of PTSD way, I don't know, but certainly it's been around for a long time as the, you know, as basically the release of this film, which I have to say, I wish I could come up with the name of it. I really do, because I imagine you would love to watch it because it's truly astounding.
I can find it. In fact, there was an editorial recently, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, comparing the aftermath of World War II, the studies that were done on the American soldier, famous sociological studies, you know, Stouffer, the American soldier.
Yeah.
There's nothing comparable. And that was a very balanced, thoughtful book that recognized both damage and men coming home back, coming back healthy, moving on with their lives. We need something like that.
Yeah.
Something more.
Yeah.
much deeper, both for Vietnam and for Iraq, Afghanistan. And mm-hmm. that tells the true story of the men who are suffering, but also is able to move beyond this notion of a kind of pathetic victimhood that recognizes that that even as one of the nurses I wrote about, even with PTSD, I came home strong.
Interesting. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, Gary, and I really appreciate it. I want to close the interview by asking you what is really our traditional final questions on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a book that I would be happy to read if I could. If I could read it, I wouldn't be working on it. But it's hard to believe that one topic that has... hasn't received the attention, worthy attention, is the story of conscientious objector medics who served in Vietnam. So that is indeed what I'm working on, and it's an emotional book for me. I gave a paper on this it's 2 years ago at Texas Tech. It serves as the kind of introduction. One long chapter written. I've got others to go, and of course, this depends very heavily on contacts. And so, if anyone out there served as a CO medic in Vietnam, I want to hear from you.
Mm-hmm.
And our story was. I don't want to make this a story of how to put it. We were all morally upright, and we were a complicated lot.
Mm-hmm.
Based on my experience, and I want to make sure that's recognized. Not all of us refuse weapons.
Yeah.
Understandably, that's part of the story.
Well, I want to say that I think I feel safe in saying that you're the perfect person to write this book.
I hope so. I hope I'm not too close to it. I want to tell these sentimental stories about CO heroes.
Well, I want you to come back on when you're done with the book, okay? Promise? Okay, that would be great.
I promise.
Right, so let me tell our listeners that we've been talking to Gary Kulik about his terrific book, War Stories, False Atrocity Tales, Swift Boaters, and Winter Soldiers, What Really Happened in Vietnam. Thank you very much for being on the show, Gary.
Thank you.
And let me say to everyone who listens to the New Books Network, we really appreciate you listening to the interviews. We like producing them, and we are very glad that you get something out of them, and I hope to talk to you later. Bye-bye.